Fingers crossed this works. First of all, welcome to my wonderful panelists. Thank you all for joining us today. Starting on my right, at the very end, we've got Güneş Tavmen, who's a Turkish internet rights expert. Merrick Badger from the Campaign Against Police Surveillance. Erin Saltman from the Quilliam Foundation. And Eleanor Saiter, who is a nomadic hacker, artist and designer. I want to dive straight in, so if I can ask you guys to kind of give a brief introduction to yourselves, and particularly, what is your experience of digital rights? How did you come to this area, and what is your relationship with this very strange phrase, nothing to hide, nothing to fear? Should we start with Güneş?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. How I got into that? I've been trying to understand techno culture for about a decade now, starting from my first master's, which was in science and technology studies. I wasn't first particularly interested in digital rights or internet or surveillance, but as things got much worse in Turkey, I found myself being really interested in the subject. I was working for a non-profit organization in Turkey, which was actually more of like CBI here, Turkish Industry and Business Association. But it's also among the most powerful non-governmental organizations in Turkey, so it's, the scope of the projects we've been carrying out were not limited to economics or business, but we were also dealing with anything related to human rights. So as the internet's regulations got tighter and tighter, we found ourselves really focusing on how to fight against censorship and surveillance. But that said, by nature of the organization I was working for, things were mostly taken from economic perspective. Because that was the rhetoric we were supposed to use, because we were supposed to sought after our members' profits. And in time, that kind of started to worry me, like, because I thought that was much more of a social problem rather than an economic and business-related problem. So I decided to go back to academia, and I did another master's in sociology, where I focused on information, communication, data, open data, smart city, etc. And particularly about surveillance, so I got into that, was one day in one of the classes during my master's, and it was a sociology course. We were talking about surveillance, we were talking about CCTVs, and we were discussing Foucault or Giddens, Lyon, like all these academics who traditionally discussed surveillance. And I remember, like, I take it as given that people would be against surveillance, right? Like, who enjoys having cameras all around, or like digital surveillance? So I took it as given, and I was just speaking against it in the class. And then my classmates were actually really in favor of CCTVs, at least, if not digital surveillance. But they really advocated for it and said, like, they felt secure and it was actually good, and it's good for preventing terrorism as well. And then as I went on challenging this idea, actually, one of the classmates, she turned to me and said, like, if you're unhappy with the CCTVs in London, maybe you should think about going back to your own country where you don't have that much of CCTVs. And that wasn't a really happy moment for me. I was really appalled, and, well, because honestly, I thought there was some element of racism there as well. So after that incident really changed my whole approach, like, not in the way that I, my views on surveillance, but I got kind of obsessed with it. And after that, I've been writing papers on it, and I've recently written a report for Association for Progressive Communications on The report was on surveillance and censorship in Turkey on the internet. Well, if you want, I can elaborate on it later.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mike Badger. I'm an environmental activist, and in 2010, a friend of mine found a passport belonging to another activist friend, and it had the wrong name on it. And we found this man had been with us for 7 years, and he'd been with his girlfriend for 6 years, utterly integrating her family, was in fact a police officer called Mark Kennedy. And since he's been exposed, we've been researching more, and we've got the details, or partial details at least, on 14 officers, but we know there have been about 150 since the political spy units were started in 1968. And they've spied on around 450 groups, they've said, in that time. And they it's clear from the range of groups they deal with that they want to deal with threats, and they don't distinguish between the threat to life and limb and the threat to corporate profit and the threat to police credibility. So you can be planning a riot, or you can be the family of Stephen Lawrence, and you will be equally targeted, you will be smeared, you will get trumped up charges. This is what they do. And probably the most shocking element of what they've done is the long-term life partner relationships, and that's not even always with activists. There's one officer called Bob Lambert who had a long involved relationship and with someone, not even an activist, just a friend of activists, but it's there to make him look like a rounded character to bolster his credibility. And so you don't even need to be an activist to be a target for the psychological and sexual abuse of police officers in this country. There's a huge database of what they term domestic extremists. A domestic extremist is anyone who does or would commit a criminal act for a political purpose, and that is pretty much everybody. We've had some Jenny Jones, who is a Green Party member of the House of Lords. They've been keeping a file on her for over 10 years. She did a subject access request and got her redacted file. Elected politicians who are so utterly within the establishment, they're in the House of Lords, still targets for these people. There's the construction industry blacklist, which was an illegal list of over 3,000 construction workers who have been political activists, trade union activists, or complained about health and safety issues. Some people, not even actually construction workers, they've just been political. And this was illegally run, and all the major construction firms would pay money to vet people before they employed them, and if you're on the list, you didn't get a job. That list was maintained with the routine help of the special branch of every constabulary in the country, a completely illegal exchange of information to run a completely legal company, and there were very high-level meetings between senior police officers to brief the company on how to run this illegal list to deny people work for being a trade unionist. A couple of hundred environmentalists on the construction industry backlist as well, for good measure, including myself. And, you know, do we really think that construction is the only industry that's got a blacklist like this, or is it just the one where the company's been caught? Yeah, and so you don't have to be an activist to be a target.
Thank you, Erin. Hi, I'm perhaps coming at this from a slightly different perspective, since I mostly deal with people that the majority of the public wouldn't mind being surveyed. I work for a counter-extremism think tank, and I track the online usage by extremist organizations and terrorist groups and decentralized jihadists and how they use social media and the internet to propagandize and distribute their messaging. However, when it comes to surveillance and legalities, it's still quite important because there are a huge amount of gray areas about the difference perhaps between an extremist and a terrorist, and legislation is quickly changing and constantly moving because of perceived fears that we are witnessing. And actually, in a democracy, we are supposed to allow for voices even if they are extreme or even if they do seem quite unwanted within society. And yet we do see movements by the government at the moment to try to create blockages and filtering against quote-unquote extremism. And yet we don't really have a working definition of what that means. As you said, almost anyone could be considered an extremist. Of course, in the language, we're perhaps looking now at Islamist extremism with the lines of a terrorist threat. But that being said, when legal structures do go through, if we are saying extremism,
even if we're implying one thing, that definition gives us a large scope to work with. And it is worrying when perhaps Theresa May makes quotes about creating extremism ASBOs, where individuals targeted as extremists could be limited to their usage of the internet and where and when they speak in public. So my background dealing with counter-extremism is actually to try to promote human rights and freedom of speech. And instead of using negative measures such as blocking, filtering, and censorship, which we see the government quite keen on all the time, not only is this ineffective and not useful, anyone that knows how online processes work, we can see one jihadist reappear 21 times with slightly different accounts and be able to reamass 20,000 followers within a couple of weeks. So that doesn't work. What we actually need to be doing is challenging ideologies, and that's more of a civil society-led effort that doesn't really have to do with censorship and government initiatives. So great. I'm taking a slightly different stance, perhaps.
Thank you.
Hi. I've spent about 9 years working in commercial security, so that's kind of my background coming into this space, was looking at how do we keep big enterprise systems safe and that kind of thing. And I spent a lot of time looking at security architecture and strategy and process change and, you know, in some ways kind of the boring end of things, but the technical tools that underpin what it means to keep a user safe, or at least that's what I thought at the time. And then I started working with high-risk users in the context of some political work I was doing, and I realized that we had basically nothing to offer them as the security community. We didn't have tools that could meaningfully keep specifically targeted users safe online. So I moved into NGO land and started working to try to fix and build those tools. And so the perspective that I bring to this is looking at people who maybe do have something to hide, but mostly those things that they have to hide are activism, political work, client, you know, lawyer confidentiality, the things that we actually want people to be able to hide, because this is a basic fundamental tenet of society. But in working with situations where that breaks down, I think we see a lot that's really useful about how these things play out. In general, my research looks at how socio-technical systems fail. So that's true when I'm doing commercial security work, because all of those systems are as much social as they are technical. And it's true when I'm working for high-risk users or when I'm doing political work. And I think it's really interesting to look at the failure modes, because they end up teaching us more about how these systems work in the end than the success cases. And sadly, when we look at privacy today, we have absolutely no shortage of failure modes.
Thank you. One of the things I was really intrigued by, Gunesh, what you said about your classmates who were very, very happy to have CCTV around because it made them feel safer. And I'd like to dig a bit more into that topic of, actually, there are people out there for whom nothing to hide, nothing to fear is a perfectly legitimate and rational approach to their privacy. And there are groups of people out there for whom it very much isn't. Even if they have nothing to hide, they have a lot to fear because they're disproportionately targeted by surveillance, by spying, by very intrusive measures from the state. So I wanted to get your thoughts from all of you on who are these respective groups, why can some people legitimately feel that they have nothing to fear, and what is the impact on the lives of the people who do actually may have nothing to hide but do have lots to fear from the state? Anybody want to kick this off? Okay. Thank you.
I think people who think they have nothing to hide, so nothing to fear, are the people who are illusions, thinking they are actually privileged, and they think they will never go through trouble in their lives because they really have deep trust in the government system, world. I don't know. I find it very naive, but obviously everybody has something to hide. I was thinking, like, when we go to toilets, when we are peeing, pooping, like, we don't want to be seen by other people. Not that we are doing something illegitimate or dodgy, but, like, you don't want to be tracked every minute, and all your activity on the internet, or, like, just which street you're going, what you are doing. Of course you want to keep something to yourself. So this is not something about, this is not about some like drug sales or gun sales or doing dodgy. I think we should really make it clear that it's not about the being privileged or like having nothing to hide, but everybody has the right to their privacy.
Yeah, surveillance would probably be fine as long as we could have utter, complete faith in the people doing the surveillance and their motivations, and for everybody who's ever going to use those surveillance systems in future. And, you know, we can't. And it's the people who feel like maybe there's, you know, nothing to hide, nothing to fear, have just never run into the state before. It's been really interesting doing the work I do, meeting with people from justice campaigns, from people of colour being killed by police and whatever, because it's not just those families who have that suspicion. It's everybody in that community. They're used to being targeted all the time. And the idea that sort of optimistic faith in state power comes from people who've never run into it, but there are huge swathes of society who are targeted for being poor, for not being white. And they already know, but as I said earlier, you don't have to be an activist. They can come for you anyway if you have a family member who dies, you know, at the hands of police or it's under investigated. They can come for you. And if you just happen to be in the family of an activist, know someone who's an activist, you're a target.
I suppose two quick points on that. I mean, first of all, the big danger is not necessarily the monitoring or surveillance itself of big data. I mean, 90% of or more of the data that's actually collected en masse is not even being really looked at. There's not the manpower to look at things. It's the issue when, as you address, that monitoring turns into hard power, or that monitoring turns into an actual effect on an individual's lives. And I think it's hard for the majority of society to really understand what that will feel like when you realize in your face how much data, if one wants to, can actually extract and expose. But in parallel to that, we are actually living in a society where we give away so much data very openly through our very open social networks. This is almost like a surveillance dreamland that we live in. We post photos on Facebook that has facial recognition. We can see networks of friend circles. We can see what ideologies an individual supports through their Twitter feeds. We create self-selective vacuums of information that people can track. It's one of those things where we might fear monitoring, but we do give a lot away in this day and age that we didn't used to. And then on top of that, what's interesting is we can much more easily create layers of anonymity. So even in trying to work with counter-extremism and counter-terrorism networks, we aren't able to really identify some of these accounts, in fact, the majority of these accounts, of actual jihadists when we're looking at beheadings on Twitter. We don't actually know who that individual is, and there's actually no way of us tracking, even talking with Twitter, Facebook, and Google. There is anonymity within these layers. So we're kind of in this paralleled world where we're giving tons away and yet also able in other spheres of our social lives to maintain a greater deal of anonymity. And that's actually not being broken. And we know that because of counterterrorism efforts where we can't actually find these individuals. We don't know who Jihadi John is. We don't know exactly or can't 100% verify who we're looking at. So this is a game-changing generation, and security forces are drastically trying to catch up. And so is civil society, because actually Pandora's box has been opened and we don't know where the new box, where those walls and confines are actually being placed right now.
So I'd like to question two things here. First of all, I'd like to strongly question the notion that we give data away. We don't give information away. We have no choice. We are not presented with ecosystems and infrastructures in which we can interact if we choose to not give these things away. The choice isn't, I can use Facebook or I can use some other network that preserves my privacy. It's, I can use Facebook or I can never go to another social engagement with my friends again. That's not a choice. And it's actually deeper than that. It's, I can use Facebook or I'm not going to get a job. Because, you know, employment basically happens through peers. You find out about jobs. That's the way most people actually get hired. If you cut yourself off from all of the tools that everyone around you wants to use to have a conversation, you are cutting yourself off from society. That's not a choice of giving information away. That is being economically and socially coerced into having no expectation of privacy. We don't have a choice of negotiating with these systems. you know, except where we do get to negotiate, you know, in those rare cases where there is meaningful consumer choice, in those rare cases where privacy-preserving systems are built and actually see a meaningful network effect. So I think that framing it as a choice of giving information away is really dangerous. And the second thing I want to question is the frame of privacy. Because increasingly what we're seeing with a lot of these large data-driven efforts are actually efforts to structurally manipulate entire populations over long periods of time. Now, for the most part, they were incredibly clumsily performed, but you know, why do we see, you know, the UK government attempting to block extremist content? It's not about some like specific targeted short-term tactical objective. What they're trying to do is they're trying to shape society as a whole over the long term. Now, you know, even if you agree with that end, do you like it when Facebook lets Tesco pay them to do the same thing? You know, these are the efforts that we're seeing. We're seeing mass data collection used to drive attempts at large-scale social manipulation. We're seeing this around the GCHQ Joint Threat Research Investigation Group, which is trying to figure out how to do political and social manipulation at scale for entire populations. So it's not really even just about privacy, although it's about privacy too, but it's about fundamental free will. It's about how do we construct ourselves as a society? Do we actually have a say in what we think?
Did you want to say a little bit more on kind of the differential impact on different types of people and groups?
So I just simply don't think that the people who don't have anything to hide and don't have anything to lose exist. There are lots of people who think they're in that group for whatever political reasons. But to start with, I challenge anyone in that group to give me their bank account details. You know, if they have nothing to hide, then clearly they have no problem with me having all of their bank details, because clearly they have nothing to hide, right? These are tools that protect us in our daily lives, in the way we go about our daily existence. You know, we all do have something to hide. In an age, if you had a society with perfect law enforcement, you know, let's pretend that you could wave that magic wand and every crime would always get caught. One of the other results that would come of that is that you would have no meaningful social change. Almost all social change involves some form of civil disobedience at some point, right? Everyone who cares about social change is a political criminal, is a domestic extremist. Everyone who might care about social change is a domestic extremist. So, you know, if we want a regime where we have nothing to hide and that's a meaningful argument, we're saying that, oh, you know, it's fine if we have no social change. So I don't think there are those two categories in the same way. Now, there are definitely people who are being targeted, and there's a difference between people who might be targeted and people who are being targeted. So there's a whole pile of people out there who definitely have things to hide, who have active security issues that they need to deal with. Their lives mostly suck, and many of them are very short right now. But there are different tools and different responses that we need for where we need to take infrastructure for society as a whole and what people who are specifically being targeted need. But I don't think it's reasonable to pretend that there is any group of people who are magically never going to be targeted. We are all in that risk. Certainly if you're in this room, you're at that risk. You know, none of you get to pretend that.
Thank you. So what I'm getting out of this discussion is actually, yes, there are lots of people who approach their privacy with a nothing to hide, nothing to fear mindset, but none of us should, that's something I tend to subscribe to personally as well. I'm interested in your thoughts on how we can start getting this message across to a wide audience. What do we do to engage both the people who feel that they have nothing to hide and nothing to fear and help them understand what's at stake, but also what do we as a digital rights community that sometimes can be very homogenous and not terribly diverse, what can we do as a community to reach out to those groups who definitely have things to fear from the state, to engage them with the digital rights campaign and to help support them, both maybe in technical terms, in legal terms, in getting them involved in this kind of campaigning. Who wants to start?
Thank you. I think that what everyone tends to do naturally, unless you really force yourself outside of it, is to preach to the choir quite a lot. And obviously anyone in the know or that's probably in this room probably feels very strongly about these issues, has stories behind these issues. And I think in any campaign where you try to reach a wider audience, it's really necessary to go outside of your own comfort zone and target your campaign outside of yourself and outside of your own social network. Some of that might also mean taking what is more easy as an online campaign and actually taking it offline. And I think sometimes there are offline initiatives that really need to be better mirrored online, like countering extremism through positive messaging. And sometimes there are online initiatives that actually need to be better taken offline to reach a wider audience, such as letting people know about surveillance, getting stories out there, and going into areas that can have their own stories made more aware to them through that sort of campaigning. So I think it's up to everyone to go outside of their comfort zone to reach a broader audience and let their information be known outside of the people that would already agree with them naturally.
I've been vocal in the U.S. talking about the way the NGO community has responded to the Snowden revelations. I'm still shocked and appalled that the parallel between stop and frisk and, for instance, NYPD's surveillance of mosques in collaboration with the CIA and the Snowden revelations in PRISM and these kind of, you know, big charismatic megafauna of the surveillance world. You know, why have we not drawn these connections? Why do we not say, look, yes, of course NSA surveillance is an issue for people of color. No, of course it's not a rich white guy problem. But this is the image it's been presented with. You know, these communities are here too. These communities are everywhere. Why are we not reaching out and saying, look, we have the same problems that you have, we being what is a mostly white surveillance, anti-surveillance community, why are we not building these bridges? You know, these community organizations exist. They are already fighting these problems in their communities. We're fighting this problem in our community. You know, and this also probably comes down to why are we not hiring more diversely in the surveillance world, which is bizarre to me. I don't understand why we have all white NGOs.
Thanks. Yeah, so my work is mostly people being directly targeted rather than just electronically surveilled. And yet the thing we're doing to kind of fight back against that is to get all the different people to start to speak with one voice and to realize that, you know, it's the, if they get justice for, say, the bereaved families and stuff, that's not justice if they don't get it for the blacklisted construction workers, for the women who had the long-term relationships. And putting these people together, it makes a clear pattern that they are, it's this level of surveillance right the way through the whole of society that's politically active, sort of on the you know, outside of the ballot box, basically. And so, and there's court cases going on with that. The women are suing the police, and we've got this to a stage where, you know, not even anyone in the police will say that what happened to those women is justifiable. And so the methods are being shamed, and it makes it harder for them to do that. Also, how they, the tricks of the infiltrators, we can now see patterns, we can now say what to look for, so we're rolling it back with that. But it's keeping that in the public eye, and the government obviously doesn't want to talk about this, and, you know, stuck its fingers in its ears, and then it's done these little bitty self-investigations in the police, but we've finally got to the point where there is now going to be a full public inquiry properly under the Inquiries Act, Leveson style, into undercover policing. And so it's keeping that going forward that this is a systemic problem. These aren't isolated cases, and that's the important thing to keep telling people.
When you say there are more vulnerable groups and or like there are these certain vulnerable groups, I agree to that to a certain extent, because honestly, I think we are all kind of vulnerable. One of the key things to challenge this whole surveillance thing is to look at the problem in a very holistic and global way, because there's a huge economic side to it as well. For example, again, with the CCTVs, there's a huge economy going behind these CCTV things, and Britain is one of the biggest exporters of CCTV technologies throughout the world. And in Turkey, all these technologies to carry out surveillance on the internet under the protection of children, to prevent child pornography, they're all both from Sweden, whereas Sweden is seen as this super democratic, amazing, beautiful country. So there is another side of it as well. And another thing is, for example, as a Turkish person, I have to go through a ridiculous amount of security control, security check whenever I need to get a visa to go to any kind of EU country. And it starts from the assumption, again, nothing to hide, nothing to fear. If I don't have any illegitimate intentions, like carry out any terroristic action or like be an illegal immigrant, why should I be scared while I'm supplying all these very personal documents, like my 6 months of detailed bank accounts, like every single money came in and came out to all of these embassies and consulates? Like, if everything is perfect, why should I be scared? But this is not the case, because it serves a certain purpose, which is to spread fear. And you always feel self-aware and self-conscious. So it's not only about, being targeted because you're an activist and you're a more vulnerable part of the society, but it's I really, really think we should look at it in a really holistic and global way.
Thank you. At this point, I'd like to ask the audience for questions. Can you? Right. Should we start at the front there, just next to you?
Hello, my name is Daniel. I'm from Berlin, and for me, it's a little hard to see that you currently have the same discussions as we had last year. We also try to decide how can we teach people, how can we give them ideas what this surveillance might end up in. And what we basically saw is that ignorance seems to be bliss and seems to be the choice, because nobody wants to think what happens when the data of your health insurance card is connected with the data of your credit card, or what happens is an algorithm decides, okay, there is cancer in the family about two generations, only offer him cheap medication that doesn't really cure because the chances are low. That was quite pessimistic. I want to encourage you to go on with that discussion. Maybe you find in the British culture certain points that work out well and that can create a wave. We saw last week in Germany a wave when this WhatsApp stuff was promoted, the two tick-offs, the first for message pushed and the second for message read. And this is where all of a sudden people reacted. There was an outcry, oh my God, privacy, privacy. Well, there's not really a question in it, but if you can have a look on Germany, we're discussing the same stuff also with the surveillance of the services, as we're currently examining our own DMD, and the problems are always the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe we can get a couple more points from the audience, and then we'll ask the panel to address them. So I think there were a couple points back there. Person in the brown t-shirt.
You spoke a little bit about how we give away lots of information voluntarily and thereby sort of help the surveillance services, and how we're potentially forced to do that because we have no choice but to use Facebook. Is it not also true that by giving away information about ourselves voluntarily, we're helping to shape society? And thereby, if we were to not do that, we'd be letting them chill the way that we can potentially affect society.
Okay, thank you. And there was a question just there, person with the scarf.
Profile
the idea of a building profile collecting vast swathes of data, that's going to be either automatically or a graph and chart, which John Campbell talked about earlier. So it's not necessarily a thing about guilt or visibility. It's more a question of they'll find any way to get your data to be a building profile beyond, in a more societal state, as opposed to guilt, sort of specific guilt or
okay, thank you. And I think there was a question just behind you. Yeah, the person just behind.
In Glenn Greenwald's book, No Place to Hide, he picks up on the phrase, "Not if you have nothing to fear, if you have nothing to hide, rather than have nothing to fear." And he says, when you turn that around, and you look at the government, you look at the financial institutions, you look at all the state institutions, because they have everything to hide, and they have everything to fear from us. So that's why we are living in the society that we are.
Okay.
There is, for example, the Channel 4 reporter Paul Mason, exasperated in the City of London, saying we can't get to the real data of these banks, and what they're doing is never revealed.
Cool, thank you. So I'll let you guys take these pretty much as you want. Anna, do you want to start?
Sure. So I guess just addressing first the social impact question, I think that it is absolutely true that, you know, yes, when we're sharing with our friends or whether we're speaking publicly, we should be able to, you know, that is participation in civil society, that is having an impact socially. When I choose to speak to an audience that is not necessarily, you know, whether it's an audience here or an audience online, that is not necessarily the same as me also wanting to address MetPol and GCHQ. You know, I mean, I assume that they have people in the room, but there's no reason that we should get to have a choice there, right? And I certainly am not intending to, you know, speak to Tesco's marketing representative. You know, he's not a friend of mine. Why would I want to talk to him? You know, so I think that by having to deal with networks where we don't get to make that control, even when we're choosing to speak publicly or more openly, you know, there's still a structure there that is coercive, that is very coercive. And when I'm speaking privately, there's absolutely no reason that I should be speaking to any of those people. On the societal profiles question, I very much agree that, yes, we're seeing those societal profiles built, but they're not just building them to read. They're building them to write. You know, you never... Intelligence data exists for a purpose. If you are gathering intelligence on some set of individuals, it's because you're intending to influence or make decisions about those individuals. And if you're a state, when you make decisions, you change the world, right? So if they're planning on developing a population-wide profile, they're planning on using it. And they're not just using it to find people.
Yeah, I'll maybe touch on the two middle points really quickly. One, the idea of that you're providing quite a lot of information, and maybe by giving that information we're shaping society. I would actually agree that maybe in the long term, I think in 10 years from now, when the government and security sector is made up of a more digitally literate, naturally digitally literate generation, there will be a little less fear around the internet, I think. Right now, it's an easy target to attack, but with generations that are raised as so digitally literate, I don't think that you can view it as such. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation at top levels, partially because we're dealing with people that are running certain positions that weren't raised, that were raised maybe with a beeper, and have been at this gap between digital literacy that's quite significant. And we see that a little bit just with legislation not working, such as the European right to be forgotten legislation that came through, and the fact that that just simply doesn't work. Point in case that the Spanish person's case who created that law, his case will never be forgotten. That piece of information that he wanted forgotten is now textbook. So we see that quite often. And the fact that actually this is a bottom-up movement, and the grassroots element of internet movement will always be a step ahead, actually, of government movements, usually because government's constantly trying to hire the grassroots level because they're more naturally innovative. So we are creating more natural and open profiles of ourselves, and maybe that could be seen as a healthy thing in the long run. And then just touching on kind of GCHQ and NSA building profiles, it's also worth looking at the fact that there is a constant dialogue and back and forth and almost a bit of a war between social media companies and GCHQ because they're saying that social media companies aren't working with them. And that's also not the case to a certain extent, because the counterterrorism internet referral unit, which is where all these deliverables are coming from that say, we've taken down 49,000 pieces of terrorist-related content in the last 3 years. Well, not only is that just a drop in the pond, that doesn't actually make much of an effect on the overall terrorism online, but also the only reason they're able to do that is because they have to submit formal REPA processes to Facebook, to Google, to have specific content taken down through flagging programs. And actually only about, for Facebook at least, 70% of the content the government requests saying that it's terrorist content, only 70% of that's taken down. That's actually it's a high number, but that's also showing a 30% reflection of them having to peer review and say, well, that's not terrorist content, or actually that's legitimate speech that is allowed on this platform. So that is taking place. And in other countries across Europe, that number is lower. In some countries, it's down to 30%, where the government's requesting takedowns and Facebook saying, no, you're not understanding what's illegal. That's not illegal speech. So we should also recognize when that dialogue is happening and when the government is not just getting their way with taking down content they believe is harmful. There is a dialogue, and on international platforms, they judge that material based on their laws, not on national laws, because they wouldn't be able to do that around the world. So it's something to consider.
Anything to add, guys?
Just a bit, yeah. The point up there of kind of policing ourselves and of freezing ourselves out of the, you know, ability to change society and taking our agency away, this is something we've got to be really wary of. You know, they can watch any electronic device, that you know, but there is a bit of so what. There is actually a lot of it. If not speaking out, you know, because you're too scared of them watching, means you don't speak to the people who should be hearing you, and so you lose your agency. And you're doing their job for them, basically. And most people aren't going to go to jail, even though, you know, I do some probably more illegal stuff than most people here with it. And we've achieved awesome things with these bastards in the middle of us, and now we know how to spot them. So, again, this not being scared of them, not letting them have a chilling effect, but realise we can still get away with more, and it's keeping on pushing and making the case against power, pointing it out, accepting, realising that they do it, but not accepting that they do it.
I'll try to make 2 points as well. First of all, like you said, actually it's corporates and governments that have something to hide and something to fear, which we observed very clearly in Turkey in the last 2 years, one and a half years after this Gezi protest, because the government was so scared and full of fear, the first thing they did was to strengthen all these regulations on the internet in terms of both censorship and surveillance. And just before I came here to the panel, I was thinking about what's my personal experience with surveillance. Actually, during these protests, I wrote a lot of things and nothing happened to me. So maybe, well, I didn't think maybe it's not bad, but I was trying to figure out. First of all, I think there's two sides to it. First of all, I realized actually I did a lot of self-censorship, and of course I was a little bit scared when I was writing comments and whatever, and most of the time I held a lot of things in me, and I didn't write things as harsh as I would. So it creates self-censorship, and I think this is what governments are trying to do, like with self-awareness, self-censorship, because it's not quantifiable. So it's not really as visible as censorship, which makes surveillance really difficult to show its consequences. And the second side to it is actually it's no guarantee that I won't be in the future accused of what I've been written, what I've been writing in these times anyway. They can always be held against me, because there was this just a very short example. There was this journalist in Turkey who was kind of against the government, let's say, and they checked his internet pass down, and because he was downloading Kurdish songs as well as following Kurdish news websites that were banned, censored in Turkey, but we all know how to circumvent censorship in Turkey. just using this against him, they put him on trial, saying he's supporting PKK, the Kurdish terror group. So like they accused him of terror, and he was put on trial, and he actually got sentenced. So you never know, that won't happen to me anytime. I hope not. If it happens, you will remember today.
Okay, we've got time for maybe one more question. Right, I think you put up your hand first at the very back. Yeah. Okay, did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a big difference between digital literacy and critical consumption, and maybe that's the point we should make. I mean, I can guarantee you that anyone 30 and below is much better at using Twitter, Facebook, creating a website, and programming than their parents. And so that's one point. We will see digital literacy regardless. I mean, one of the reasons why, just from my own work, Islamic State, everyone's so shocked that they are tweeting, and so shocked that they are creating coding, and so shocked that they're creating apps that can take over your device. All that means is that they had some 19-year-old techie kids that happened to be supporters of a terrorist cause. We should not be shocked, and in fact, that'll be a game changer, and looking forward, that will be the threat. That this is another reason, perhaps, why also governments are fearing the internet as a whole. But I think the understanding that the internet is a tool, it's not a causal factor, it's a tool being used to create ends to means. And I do think that the generation is quickly moving towards digital literacy, but there is an issue of critical consumption. So there is an issue that perhaps we're not questioning where information is coming from, where our information is going, and what's being used. And that's the part that needs to be taught better. I mean, that can be taught through education systems, although that would require government wanting that to be part of a curriculum, which is perhaps something we're all a little skeptical of. But we do need to see that start happening, and that really does need to happen from a bottom-up approach of making sure that's aware and taught, so that future generations aren't just digitally literate but are critical consumers.
Okay, thank you. In the interest of lunch, I'll ask you to kind of sum up in 30 seconds each, please, if you've got anything to address either that question or just general conclusions.
I guess, you know, the next time someone tells you they have nothing to hide, tell them what they do have to hide, and tell them that, you know, it may not be just about them, that we as a society need to support people who legitimately have things to hide. Because one of the things that we've seen in so many places is that the way people are actually convinced on any political issue is by the people they know. So talk to your friends, talk to your parents, talk to your obnoxious neighbors who you really disagree with politically, but do it anyway, because it will actually make a difference.
Yeah, relating to that, I mean, I think everyone here agrees that we all have something to hide, and that's privacy. We all want something within our lives that isn't completely exposed. And we all have something to lose by that, because that can be leveraged in some way. But that being said, that doesn't mean we should feel that that should suppress us in our daily lives, and that doesn't mean that that should make us silenced. And in fact, the disregard for that and the vocalizing, and you cannot live in a suppressed feeling even though you know there are perhaps suppressive infrastructures around you. The history can show time and time again that actually, you know, the grassroots are the many, and that pyramid structure is just a few at the top. And really, if you can consider times in the past, you know, the TV revolution, this revolution of everyone being online is overwhelming. History will no longer be written by the winners. history will be written and remembered by those who make a point of making their voice heard and remembered. So I think that should be empowering, not fearful.
This isn't going to go away. Governments and corporations have huge power, and power tends towards abuse, and power with impunity and no transparency tends towards abuse even more. So we have to realize this isn't going to be something we ever win. This is going to be an ongoing struggle, but the way we do that is to keep talking to each other and to keep calling out power as we're doing, and to keep the voice heard and not to do their job for them by keeping quiet.
I just want to emphasize that this is not a problem related to technology, that the technology advanced and this happened. This is a social and political problem. So I think we have to fight power asymmetry at all levels and not just rely on VPN or Tor and try to come up with new technologies that circumvent surveillance or censorship, but battle on more social and legal ground.
Thank you all very much. I believe now it's time for lunch. But thank you to my wonderful panel.